Neil Whiteside
on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We're going to talk money, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Tim Adenall. Tim is the head of the private client team at Woodfine Solicitors, and Paul Fox, who's head of financial planning. He's also a director at NW Brown. Good afternoon to you both. Welcome to the studio.
Good afternoon.
Tim, I know you. Yes, like I said, I know you've been in before. Paul, first timer.
It is indeed.
It's lovely to see you both here. Tim, just remind us about Woodfines.
Woodfines, all discipline practice based on Clarendon Road in the south of the city. Also have offices in Bedford and Milton Keynes. Only area that we don't cover is crime, other than regulatory white-collar crime.
Okie dokie. And NW Brown, of course, Paul, big name in the city and has been for many a year. Tell us about them.
Yeah, very well known. Been in Cambridge for 40 years or so now. Two offices based, Cambridge and Norwich. Wealth Management Services, which is basically the bringing together of financial planning and investment management.
Okay.
Looking after all our clients' planning and investment needs.
Okay, super. And we've got you both together today because it seemed like a good idea to just try and get some sort of head around. I'm sort of heading towards retirement, and it's not until you head towards retirement you look back and think, well, I wish I'd done things differently. And there was sort of some funny sort of attitudes to money when I was young. Paul, you've done some work into this. What have you found?
Well, I think coming close to retirement is one of the key areas where we find new clients come and see us. We've identified three key times that clients need planning advice.
Right.
One is in the earlier years, younger families when they're accumulating wealth. One is, as you've just mentioned, Neil, when people approach retirement and they're thinking about their needs in retirement, when can they retire, what their income requirements would be. And the final one is once they're well into retirement, they've established their capital and their income requirements and they have excess and they're looking to gift that away to the future generations before the tax man comes in and death and grabs a healthy slice of it.
And we do just hear more and more of this, don't we? That if you don't get it right, then frankly, not the penalties, but there's so many ways you could have taken advantage, so many things you could have done to protect yourself and to protect those left behind. And if you don't get it right from the start, it can all go painfully wrong, can't it? We hear about people having to sell the house, sell the farm type thing just to pay the tax bills.
Well, there's one of those depressing facts that if you've got two children and you don't structure things in a very tax-efficient way, that potentially the largest beneficiary of your estate will be HMRC.
Is that right?
Because inheritance tax is at 40%, so that only leaves 60% for your two children, so that's 30% each. So the revenue take the biggest slice.
I'm with you on that one.
I'm not convinced that's what many people would choose.
No, because whilst we love our government and we love what they're doing,
they spend it so wisely.
Yes, don't they just? So where do we start? And at what point should you start and think about your financial security and your future?
I think as soon as possible is the obvious answer to that. I think most of us, when we start our first employment, we're putting money into the company pension, normally just into the default fund that's offered to us. I think that's a good starting point.
Well, it's kind of, that has been changed. Legislation sort of came in. Everyone's got to be offered it if you've got more than five employees or something.
Yeah, correct. You've got the auto-enrolment rules which came into place a few years ago. So everyone, in theory, who's a working adult will have a pension of some sorts. But they're still woefully underfunded. Hmm. Most people will not have enough money in their pensions to fund the sort of retirement that they would like to have. And there's a very small percentage of the population which are ahead of the game in that aspect.
Okay. So what, I mean, when you're young, you're starting out, you this whole money thing, when you get your first paycheck, you think, well, that's great, that's down the pub.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's the computer games that I was never had enough pocket money to buy or anything. But you should be putting away more than just this sort of statutory amounts that, again, deducted out your pay packet.
Certainly. I mean, for almost everyone, that should be the case. And again, you get the cumulative effect of having that money invested for longer. The sooner you put the money in, the greater the effect you'll get in 10, 20, and 30 years' time.
And would you put that into a pension, or is there other ways that you can invest it that are perhaps a bit more flexible and a bit better?
Yeah, I think there's lots of other ways. I think the ISA is the other key investment wrapper that we see younger clients using. The benefits of the ISA, you don't get any tax relief in the same way that you do with the pension, but the money is available to you. Right. Whether that's a cash ISA or a stocks and shares ISA, you can go and take that money out at any point in the future. And as we've seen, obviously, over the last 15, 20 years, the value of property or the price of property going through the roof. It's very difficult for younger people now to get on the property ladder. So a lot of people need that flexibility if they're putting money into investments that they can go and go into that wrapper at a future date and perhaps take some of that out.
Yeah, yeah, you don't want to see it, look over there and think, well, it's all there, but I can't get it here, which is, is
the
problem.
That's the problem, I think. ISAs are an easier sell because of the accessibility, whereas when you're young, pension age seems so far into
40
the future.
Seems like old when you're young, doesn't it?
and it's the same with making a will. Everybody thinks, kids think they're indestructible.
Yeah,
and it doesn't always work out that way. And that's one of the reasons we have a basic saying that everyone over the age of 18 ought to have a will and ought to have a lasting power of attorney. And the reason we say that is that accidents happen. Cycling accidents is an obvious example in this city.
We see it every day in this city, don't we? Every day.
And if you haven't got those basic structures in place, it can leave an awful lot of problems for those who are trying to either look after you or look after what you have left behind.
Okay, just explain what a lasting power of attorney is, because some people hear that and go, what does one
do? A lasting power of attorney is a document that you sign now saying who you would want to look after your affairs if you're unable to do so. And unable to do so covers a whole spectrum from being posted abroad and not being able to sign stuff here.
Right.
Right the way through to dementia and not knowing anything about the assets or having the mental capacity to manage things.
Okay, and with a will, how easy is that? What do you need to think about when you start to write up a will? What's the solicitor going to want to know?
You're going to want to know roughly what assets you've got, because that will determine the significance of inheritance tax, and that's then structures possibly needed along with Paul to make sure that they're tax efficient. You want to know what your family structure is, what responsibilities you have in terms of dependents. And you need, in an ideal world, to be thinking, okay, so I've got my core set of beneficiaries. If you're married, then you've got your other half, your children. But certainly, again, going back to the accident that is completely unforeseen, when you've got little children, you do quite often travel around as a family unit. And you should have something in place to cover what happens if
all of you go.
Yes. And it's one of those things where if you are going to sit down and do the documents, and this is the same with a power of attorney as with a will, there's a cost involved to it. So you might as well make it work as hard as possible for you, so that you're covering not just one scenario but several.
Yes, and the thing, I made a will. I took advice when I was very young, and I'd made a will. Basically, what you're saying as well, Paul, as soon as money starts coming in, isn't it? As soon as you start getting a regular flow of income in, you should be saving some, there should be some in a pension, there should be some tucked away elsewhere, and you should have all the legal paperwork in place to protect you and those around you to make sure that money is looked after. The thing I found when I made my will was you can build in all these, and if this happens, and if this happens, so you can assume there may be children, and there may be you can build in loads of things. You haven't got to think, every 5 minutes I need to keep changing things, have I? You can set a lot up.
You can
ahead
set
of time.
A lot up, and then the advice that we give is keep an eye on what is said in each budget, because that may affect taxation, obviously, but also look at what you have in place at least every 5 years, because family circumstances may change. You may have children. Your children grow older. You may have grandchildren. Parents may die. You may inherit money. You may be diagnosed with some sort of illness that then means you need to cater for the consequences of that. So it isn't a case to sit down once and then think, thank goodness, that's it. You need to keep reviewing it. But the idea of making sure that you've got the right structures in place, and this is true just as much with finances as well, is that you then don't have to worry about it. It's meant to take the worry away.
Yes.
It's not meant to be a worry.
No. Okay, so we've got that all set up at the start. Where do we go next, Paul?
Well, I think one thing we've missed so far as well is actually protecting that income as well.
Right.
when you've got a young family, there's often the case that one of the parents is at home looking after them. You tend then often with a lot of families to have one key breadwinner. And I think it's about ensuring that their lives are insured, that their income is protected in some way. Lots of good employers will have that covered to some degree. But I think you've always got to think from the family unit, if the main breadwinner, anything was to happen to them, and that could be death, that could be incapacitated in some way, that the family is protected.
Right.
And widening that as well, if you're a family business and you've got certain key members that drive the business, there's protection that you can put in place for that as well, and that's something else to think of. It's a different side of the same coin, really.
Sure. So there's some paperwork and there's some policies type thing. You can actually spend money and insure in that way, and also there's paperwork that you can put in place to make sure that should anything happen to a key member, that the business doesn't go, well, hang on a minute, we're in trouble now.
I think when you don't have it, as you quite rightly said, you're not thinking about it. Then when you first get it, you're thinking about going out and having fun and spending it. But once a family comes along, I think everything really changes at that point. And most people tend to get serious about their finances at that point as well. Yeah.
And do they nowadays? Just as an aside, I mean, when I was at school, there was very little of this talked about. There was very little financial planning, very little advice. You were just about told where to go and get a bank account. Do we see more common sense in our young nowadays? Do they get an idea that they do need to manage their money?
I'm not sure that's always the case. And I think sort of education at schools would be a good way of addressing that. I don't think many people leave school with that knowledge. I think what we find in the Cambridge client base is that a lot of the clients that we've had for a long time involve their children in their financial affairs. They also then see the benefits of having money in an investment portfolio rather than just leaving it in the bank. They probably see the benefits of not spending it all and getting some of it invested and seeing that cumulative effect as well. So I still think it's the message, if you like, is reaching a very small part of the population.
Right, OK. We're going to take a break for the travel, and then we're going to come back and talk about other ways of investing. Because as you just said there, leaving the money in the bank, interest rates have been horrendously low, which is great for borrowers, hideous for savers for a decade now. Yeah. So there's got to be other ways your money can be working, because presumably if you're leaving your money sitting in a bank or a building society and some of these accounts, it's losing value in real terms, in the real world.
Exactly. Probably by a couple of percent a year at the moment.
So we'll find out ways of minimising that loss in just a second. 26 minutes past three, my studio guests are Tim Adnall from Woodfine Solicitors and Paul Fox from NW Brown. We're talking about investments and basically the life cycle of people. And we've already talked about, as soon as the money starts to come in, you need to think not only about a pension, but about tucking some away for use on not in a rainy day, but when you need it later in life, when you need that deposit on a house, because you do need bigger amounts of money nowadays. And as Tim's been saying, get a will, get a lasting power of attorney in place, because as soon as that money comes in, if anything goes wrong, you need the right paperwork in place to make sure you're protected. So we were talking about bank rates and leaving the money in the bank. That seems like the only person who wins at the moment is the bank. Is that right, Paul?
Well, indeed. I mean, you've got inflation running at around about 3%, something of that. Most clients I speak to these days are getting less than 1%. For any savings they've got in the bank. I think if you can lock it away for 2 or 3 years, you might be up at 2%, slightly above it, something like that. But it's still not a win. It's still not a long-term investment strategy.
No.
And for our clients who've got money in the bank, it's really what's their comfort level? What do they need to have there so that they can actually put the rest of their money to better use?
Right, so they need to budget for a cushion. So if you need to suddenly, if the car goes wrong and you need 600 quid to fix the gearbox or something, you need to be able to draw that from somewhere, that's ready cash. But what do you do with the rest of it then?
For most of our clients, it's about building a diversified portfolio. It's about speaking to them, knowing the level of income that they perhaps require from the investments, knowing the level of risk that they are comfortable taking, knowing crucially what their capacity for loss is as well. Some clients have lots of other assets elsewhere. The money we're managing for them might be a small part of their overall wealth.
Right.
For other clients, it's almost all of their wealth, probably apart from the property that they're living in. So it's really about getting that balance correct between the different asset classes, cash, property, bonds and equities, and making sure that we can get a good balanced portfolio that then gets them returns in excess of inflation Because ultimately, the client needs to be rewarded for the risk that they're taking with those investments.
Yeah, yeah. And have we seen that over recent years? I mean, we had the big crash in 2007, 2008, everything, you know, spiraled out. Are we back and recovered? If you left your money in, are we doing all right now?
We are. I mean, we've just had a recent drop of almost 10% over the last few weeks, so that's obviously had an impact on client portfolios, or everyone's portfolio. But yeah, we have. I mean, we've seen since, I think it was March 2009 was the very bottom of the market. Since then, we've seen very strong growth in the market. FTSE itself has got back above the levels it was at in 2007, has recently dropped back under and slightly back above it again. So it's been a tough one, because if you go back to 2000 and you had the tech bubble busting there as well, and we had sort of years of market falls on the back of that. But clients are benefiting from having money in the large cap, the UK market, and getting the strong dividend returns from those as well.
And is the UK a good place to stay? I mean, bear in mind, we're just a few months away now from the dreaded B word.
Yes,
how is that? How's that affecting things?
It's affecting lots of conversations that we're having. Clients, everyone's talking about it. Everyone's worried about it. Will we get a deal? Won't we get a deal? And how will that affect portfolios? For the most part, we are a UK-centric investor.
Right.
But for most of our clients, they'll find that the bulk of their investments are in large caps. Large cap UK market, the FTSE 100, most of the earnings are generated overseas. What we actually saw on the back of the Brexit vote originally back in 2016 was on the Friday morning, the market didn't like it. There was a bit of a sell-off. It dropped by about 5%. But then sterling devalued by 20, 30% against other major currencies. So if you're sitting holding a portfolio of UK large cap shares, you're then seeing when earnings are reported back to the UK, they've risen by 20 or 30%.
Because the pound's gone so weak. Yeah, away you go.
Yeah. I think everyone's cautious at the moment. And it's an old truism that markets hate uncertainty.
Yeah.
And whatever deal is done, that will give some certainty to the major corporates who can actually plan for a known set of circumstances. And hopefully that will then bring some confidence back.
I think with all these things, isn't it, it's don't do the short term nowadays, isn't it? It's just hang fire. If you can afford to hang fire, it tends to work out all right in the end. We see it with so many things. We've seen it with property in the past, and people thinking, oh, this is amazing, and then the bottom falls out the market, but it comes back up again, doesn't it?
Don't try to be too clever.
Right.
I think you could say that in financial terms, you can say that in legal terms. One of the things, as far as we're concerned, is there are always schemes that look to take the value of your own home out of the inheritance tax net. That's like a red rag to a bull for the revenue and the government. So there is no guarantee that any one of those is going to succeed. So do you really need to chance it? You'll probably pay big fees for something that may not work. Whereas if you're prudent and invest for the long term and plan for the long term, that's likely to have a better outcome. When you're looking to provide for your retirement, you don't need to chase the biggest bucks. You know, you don't need to make the biggest gambles. You need to keep ahead of inflation,
right?
As Paul was saying, and that's what you need to be looking at. But the later you start, the more difficult it is, because the smaller your pot of investment, the less your cushion for
And you're talking about there about providing for your own retirement, but at what point should you start and think about moving money out and securing it away in a tax efficient way for your descendants, you know, for the people who are going to, for the beneficiaries under your will? Is there any clever ways of doing, you know, things you should think about if you think, I'm really not going to use it? Maybe if you inherit money from your parents, say you get, you know, pile of cash out of their house, should you put some of that, really lock it away and sort of take it out of your...
I think there's locking it away and locking it away. I think if you put money into the market, you're theoretically, in your head, you've got to think, I'm putting this in here for the long term.
Right.
Realistically, unless you go for some sort of esoteric investment, the sort of thing we wouldn't generally touch with a barge pole, you should have access to your money. If you need to get out in an emergency, it should be there. Obviously, if it's inside of a pension, then it's all the rules that apply to the pensions in terms of what age you can access that. I think when it comes to sort of thinking about passing on wealth to future generations, for the most part, unless a client is incredibly wealthy, then really they've got to get themselves to retirement.
Right.
They've got to pay off their debts. They've got to see what their income looks like in retirement versus their expenditure. Is there an excess there? What is their capital position? There's a thing that's called the retirement smile, which is people spending quite a lot of money when they first retire because they're doing lots of travelling, spending money, doing all the stuff they couldn't do before when they were working. then the sort of the middle part of it, where a bit older, you know, can't be bothered. They've done all the stuff they wanted to do, but then you've got the potential for things like care home fees coming at the end of it as well. Yeah. So I think you've got to be, when you're planning for a client, you've really got to have a very flexible approach. And I think Tim would agree with this. We do it with all our clients. See them as regularly as possible. Yes. You know, we generally see our clients every year, so we can sit down and say, here's the changes in legislation. Is there any change in your personal circumstances? Here's what we think you should be doing.
Right. If you go back to my look at everything 5 years, Paul's smile thing is a good illustration of that, because 5 years from when you've just retired takes you further down the smile, as it were, and then 5 or 10 years on beyond that, you'll be coming up the other side, potentially into those more expensive situations. I think from our perspective, the simple answer to your question would be the earlier you can look to minimise the value of your estate for inheritance tax purposes, the better. The basic rule is if you make a gift to another individual and survive for 7 years, the value of that falls outside your estate.
Right.
So that's an incentive to give early rather than late.
Thanks.
But
there is
always a but. Yeah. What you don't want to do is focus solely on the tax saving, give away pretty much everything you've got, and then find that you've left yourself short.
Yes. Yeah, no, point taken. What about this thing about, because the rules with pensions changed, didn't they, a few years ago, and suddenly, is it 55 now, you can start and draw bits out, transfer pensions out, take lumps out. Struck me as a very dangerous game.
It's not really panned out that way. There was a sort of a buying Lamborghinis.
Yes, that's exactly.
I mean, for the sort of client who can actually pull out £100,000 plus, and with the pension contract, you've generally got 25% tax-free lump sum.
Right.
Now, to have £500,000 in there to be able to pull out enough as your tax-free lump sum to buy a Maserati or a Lamborghini, whatever it is, most clients who've got that level of investments know the value of having that money invested.
Right.
So again, for our clients, we're really looking at what are they going to do with that money? You know, what are they going to do with that £125,000? If they've got debts to pay off, if they want to start gifting, then that's a sensible conversation to have. Mm. But if they're simply going to take it and put it in the bank, because a lot of people have this distrust about pensions, and we see it all the time. Clients are going, I've been putting into this for 40 years, I now want my money back.
Yeah.
The benefits of leaving it in a modern pension contract is that it will be written under trust, and it's essentially one of the best intergenerational tax planning tools you can get.
Right.
Because I can leave that to my wife, children, they can then use it as they see fit, they can then pass it on down the line, and it's staying outside, under current legislation, staying outside of the inheritance tax rules.
Estate. So they're much more flexible than they used to be. And I think pensions advice generally is an area where If people haven't looked at their pension situation for a while, it is where advice is essential. Mm. Another problem that exists at the moment is only ever going to get worse because of a more fluid job population, is where you have a small pension from one employer, you move, you have a small pension with another. Accumulating those and managing them under the same strategy will undoubtedly be better than leaving them all to bumble along under their own steam, neglected.
Yeah, excellent. All right, well, lots to think about there, I guess. A lot of people think, oh, I didn't realise it was quite like that. I guess, like all these things, it's get advice and get reputable advice, because there's ads running on the telly at the moment warning about pension scams and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. So it's get advice, get sound advice, isn't it?
And get joined up advice as well.
Yeah, and this is where you two are saying you work a lot together.
We do indeed. I mean, we work with clients on a regular basis, and I think it really helps if you've got all of your professionals who help you manage your money, your life, in one room and having joint meetings. I think it really benefits the clients.
You get properly rounded advice that way.
Excellent. Good advice. Thank you, gentlemen. Well, Tim Adnall from Woodfines and Paul Fox from NW Brown, thank you for coming in this afternoon. If you want to find out more of this, or if you're missing this, or you've been driving along listening to it, it'll be available as a podcast on the Cambridge 105 radio website in the next couple of days. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.